Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, May 2nd, 2013. U.S. troops have been deployed in northern Africa in the nation of Mali. That's the breaking news today. Now, it's a small contingent. 10 soldiers are being dispatched to provide liaison support to French and African troops. We're told that they are boots on the ground but not engaged in combat operations. And a dozen others have been assigned to guard the U.S. Embassy in Bamako, the capital of Mali. And this may be the end of it. This could be a very limited deployment. But it's important to note that as recently as January 15th, the former Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, said there is no consideration of putting any American boots on the ground at this time. And it appears that we've had covert forces there for at least a year, because in April of 2012, three American soldiers were killed in a mysterious car crash in Bamako. This according to the left-leaning, the industry, I'm sorry, I get caught up in my own characterizations. This is from the Washington Post, all right? The stenographer to the national security apparatus. And so I don't want to sound overly alarming, but I will point out that there has been no debate. There's been no public rationale offered for why we need to deploy American troops in Mali. France has 4,000 soldiers there who were deployed in January of this year, and France hopes to withdraw most of those soldiers by the end of the year. But this is not our war. Mali was once a French colony, or at least part of one, if I remember correctly. And this is another case where we don't have enough public debate, enough transparency about what the U.S. AFRICOM is up to, and about why we are putting even small numbers of troops into Mali at this stage. Now, we recently announced that we have a new drone base in northern Africa. And I am concerned that these kinds of creeping missions can expand and become the next Vietnam or Iraq. And I believe that the American people are owed an explanation and a vigorous political debate by our elected leaders before these kinds of decisions are made. The other day, I took the rare opportunity to offer praise for President Obama on three separate issues. One, his new call to close Guantanamo. We'll get to that in a moment. Number two, his continued caution about U.S. military involvement or expanded U.S. military involvement in Syria. And number three, last Friday, he gave a speech to Planned Parenthood in Washington and said that he will support their efforts to push back on restrictions on abortion rights and efforts to curtail access to contraception. And as noted by the New York Times lead editorial in today's paper Thursday, the president has betrayed reproductive rights that he embraced and his promise to operate on a science basis, not subject to politics or skewed by an agenda. Now, we've talked about how recently Judge Edward Corman of the Federal District Court in New York ordered the FDA to make the morning after pill, the Plan B contraceptive. It's not an abortion pill. It is a contraceptive. Judge Corman excoriated the Obama administration and Health and Human Services Secretary Catherine Sebelius because they injected politics into a decision to arbitrarily limit access to the Plan B contraceptive to women 17 and older. And Judge Corman said there is no scientific basis for an age restriction and ordered the FDA to make it available over-the-counter with no age restrictions. Yesterday, the Obama Justice Department announced it would appeal that federal court ruling. And they have edged downward from the arbitrary age 17 standard that Ms. Sebelius imposed to the age of 15 now, which they say is based on a detailed study conducted by the Food and Drug Administration. I don't understand why the Obama administration would not just declare a victory with the federal court ruling and say, look, you know, we wanted to put some restrictions on this. The court won't let us. Isn't that a shame? It is completely incoherent that they would challenge this and try to split the difference between no age restriction and the new standard of 15 instead of 17. And obviously, they fear political fallout from ignorant people, the willfully ignorant pro-lifers who twist science to make the case that the morning after pill is an abortion pill. And the other day, I spent a couple of minutes listening to Rush Limbaugh, and somehow an intelligent caller had gotten past his screener and was pushing back on this very issue, saying that, you know, Rush, you're a less government guy. Why do you believe the government should interfere with access to a medication? And Rush was caught off balance, if he's ever on balance. And he reverted to rehearsed talking points about abstinence and how wherever it's tried, abstinence works. And the ignorance of that. To imagine that people aren't going to engage in sexual activity because Rush Limbaugh thinks abstinence is a good thing. And for the government to try to determine at what age a woman is sexually active and therefore at what age she should control her body, that is a pointless, futile exercise. And that's what the Obama administration is going to court over. And here's the second last paragraph from the New York Times editorial. The Justice Department's legal argument, moreover, is incoherent. In court documents, it claims that Judge Corman's order improperly interferes with the FDA's scientific judgments pertaining to the drug approval process. But it was Secretary Sebelius's interference with science that sparked Judge Corman's ruling in the first place. In an in-depth interview package released for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, the opening segment is with investigative reporter Dave Lindorf. And he has been looking into some of the questions arising from the crime scene at the Boston Marathon on April 15th. And in particular, as was reported within 48 hours of the events, the arrival of an unmarked black SUV, it's a Chevy Suburban, with some very high-tech antennas mounted on the roof. And from that SUV emerged several people in the same uniform, khaki pants, a black jacket with a little insignia on it. And by digging into this, Dave Lindorf has figured out that those people worked for a security contractor firm, a mercenary firm, called Kraft International. And while Rachel Maddow and others in the corporate media are busy on a preemptive basis attacking anyone who raises questions about the official narrative of the Boston Marathon bombing and its investigation, Dave Lindorf is not afraid to ask these questions. He's not spinning any conspiracy theory. He's just saying, who are these guys? Why were they there? Who hired them? And who did they report to? And in this excerpt from our interview, Lindorf recaps the runaround that he has gotten when he asked the simple question, who are they? Why were they there? So let's recap here, Dave. You're trying to find out who hired these security specialists to be at the Boston Marathon.
Right.
And they're clearly authorized to be there because of their interaction with the FBI and other first responders.
Yes. So nobody sees them as being in the way.
Right. So you start with the Boston Police Department. And they tell you, well, you got to go to the FBI because it's not our...
Oh, that's right. It was the police. The order was the Boston Marathon, New York State Emergency Management Office.
You mean Massachusetts?
Boston. Yeah.
Right.
In Massachusetts.
Right.
Then the Boston cops.
Uh-huh.
And the cops said, call the... everything has to come from the FBI division office. So
okay.
I called the division office. And they were the ones that I overheard... discussing it and what the appropriate answer to give me would be.
And so then you call the company itself at a headquarters location, allegedly in Dallas, and then you call the Department of Homeland Security.
Right. And there, the woman wouldn't give me her name in the public affairs office, but she said that they couldn't answer any questions, that I would have to submit it in writing, and so I did, and it's now been like more than a week, and they don't respond, so that's
mm-hmm.
just a blow-off, which is all I've ever gotten from Homeland Security. They don't answer the press.
So what we have here is a hot potato scenario where they keep passing it to someone else, but nobody actually will give you a straight answer.
Right.
And is it also fair to say that when you talked to these people, did it seem like you were the first person who was asking them?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Nobody else is doing it.
The full interview with Dave Lindorf is available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, Stitcher, and other outlets. We're now up on TuneIn, a radio service for internet radios. So wherever we are, I hope you will find us. And I would like to invite you to support our work by subscribing. We offer a 24-hour pass for $1. It's $5 a month. You can cancel any time. Or $50 for a one-year subscription. And your subscription helps support the work that I do here at these podcasts. And I would very much appreciate if you'd take out a subscription if you haven't already. Also, I want to note in relation to the Boston bombing and the just deplorable media coverage that followed. And Dave Lindorf and I go through John King's blunders in the in-depth interview. That the media needs to accept responsibility for the death of a young man who was attending Brown University. As I understand it, he had taken this semester off. His name was Sunil Tripathi. And in the chaos following the bombings in Boston, on several websites, social media, and the website called Reddit, he was identified, mistakenly, by rank amateurs as a suspect in the bombing. And it made his life so miserable that last week he apparently committed suicide. His body was pulled from the water off Indian Point Park in Rhode Island. And so we had three people killed in the bomb attack itself. Then there was the MIT security cop. And now we have a fourth fatality. And his death is, I believe, properly laid at the feet of the media outlets that were recklessly and ruthlessly trying to get the story. And they didn't get it right. They got a lot of things wrong. And this young man and his family paid a huge price for it. I have not yet heard any effort at apology from media outlets in this country. The hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, continues, and it is being more widely acknowledged. My friend and colleague Andy Worthington, in support of former Gitmo prosecutor Morris Davis, who has launched a petition drive. Well, lots of people are signing this petition. There are over 112,000 signatures, and that number is probably a little stale now. They're aiming for 250,000. I'm going to put up a link in the show file for this podcast. You go to Andy Worthington's website, you read Morris Davis's article, and at the end there is a link to the petition. I hope that you will sign it and use your magic on Facebook or Twitter or whatever other networks you're connected with. We need to push this hard and keep the pressure on. To its credit, today the New York Times and the Washington Post both have articles about the ethics of force-feeding inmates on a hunger strike and whether medical professionals have an obligation to decline an order to insert feeding tubes or use other methods to force someone to take in nourishment. And I'll put up a link to the discussion, it's called Room for Debate, that's underway at the New York Times website. Our friend Vince Warren, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, is one of the participants. And I am, as somebody who's been ranting and raving about Guantanamo almost endlessly for years now, there is some gratification that people on a big scale are paying attention again to Gitmo and to the crisis there for those who are trapped with no way out, no legal process that they can rely on. And it's time for the president to step up and show leadership. Yes, he offered a very strong statement at his press conference the other day. But as we pointed out yesterday, he has prerogatives. He can order the Secretary of Defense to use the waiver process to release men from Guantanamo tomorrow. And if he only released a handful of the 86 men who are already cleared for release, it would send a powerful signal to those on a hunger strike that maybe it's not completely hopeless. And so, yes, I praise the president for his news conference remarks. Now, we need to relentlessly push for action. And I hope you'll be a part of that. Jeffrey Kay, the psychologist and part-time journalist who has written many important stories about the forced medication and the human medical experiments that are conducted on our detainees at Guantanamo, he has a new article up at Fire Dog Lake, and I'll post a link to it as well. And he points out that the 2006 memo written by Stephen Bradbury, who was working in the Bush-Cheney Justice Department, that the memo that authorized torture and that embedded the rules in the Army Field Manual on Interrogation have never been changed. Obama said, we don't torture. He issued an executive order on his first day. Of course, that was the same executive order that was supposed to close Guantanamo. And despite the fanfare and the public perception that Obama has removed the authorization for the use of torture in the official Army Field Manual, it's all still there. I have several stories about fracking that have come across my desk already today. Item one in the San Francisco Chronicle, an enterprise story by David Baker, who points out that hydraulic fracturing requires massive amounts of water and that fracking in drought regions is a really bad idea for two obvious reasons. One is, if you already have a shortage of water, to use large amounts for fracking when people need it for drinking and water their lawns and take showers, well, that's not sensible. The other piece is, in a drought zone where the groundwater may be already depleted, the risk of underground earthquakes, which is the intention of fracking, is even greater. And I heard a caller to the Norman Goldman radio show the other day make a very important point that nuclear power plants that sit on earthquake faults or sit on aquifers that may be depleted or altered because of fracking? That's one of the risks that I haven't seen put on the table. Not so far. Steve Horn, who is our go-to guy about fracking and who writes at desmogblog.com, has two important stories in the last couple of days. One is about what he calls the Keystone Cops, and these are those who are greasing the skids to get the approval for the Keystone XL pipeline. And he points out that TransCanada, the multinational corporation hoping to build the northern half of the pipeline, spent over $280,000 in the first quarter of this year alone on lobbying in Washington, D.C., including $250,000 to Paul Elliott. Who's Paul? He is their in-house lobbyist for TransCanada and the former national deputy campaign manager to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when she ran for president in 2008. Who could have more juice in the Obama-Clinton administration than the guy who was running Hillary's campaign, or one of the key people? And that's just one example of the conflicts of interest and the crony networks that have popped up to support the Keystone XL pipeline. Also, Steve Horn published a piece the other day about the mountains of sand that are required in the fracking process and how we are using mountaintop removal, similar to what goes on in coal country, to extract this sand and ship it to the fracking sites. I'll put up a link to that story, too, in the podcast show file at peterbcollins.com. And finally, on the fracking front, I want to recommend a visit to truthout.org, because right now they are doing a special series, a kind of national tour of fracking sites. They call it the Fracking Road Trip Series, and they've started the first installment with a dispatch from Cooks Valley, Wisconsin, written by Mike Ludwig. They also have companion stories about fracking ourselves to death in Pennsylvania, and other issues as well. So I want to recommend that you check out the fracking updates at truthout.org. President Obama nominated Penny Pritzker, the billionaire heiress to the Hyatt Hotel fortune who raised hundreds of millions of dollars for him in his 2008 campaign, to be the Secretary of Commerce. A clear political payback. Penny Pritzker is part and parcel of the bankster-gangster problem in this country. And I guess the president feels that he's got nothing to lose by rewarding his friends. That's an ugly one. Almost as ugly as the nomination of the proposed chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler. And in an upcoming conversation we'll release here in the next few days, former FCC Commissioner Nicholas Johnson lowers the boom on that nomination. Meanwhile, Obama has a three-day trip out of the country. He's going to Mexico, to Costa Rica, and in Mexico City, he is facing the new president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, who is dialing back the war on some drugs in Mexico that has claimed over 60,000 lives and wreaked all kinds of havoc. And the Obama administration appears to be puzzled and concerned about this shift south of the border. And it's just another case of a failed policy that has a life of its own, and cowardly political leaders right up to the president who aren't willing to acknowledge that the war on some drugs is a total and colossal failure, that prohibition doesn't work, that we have tens of thousands of dead people who can testify to that reality. And lastly today, on May 1st, yesterday, we had people marching in the streets all over the world. It was workers' May Day, And in many countries where austerity has been imposed, the workers had real grievances to express. It was also the scene for protests demanding immigration reform all across the United States. Tampa, Bozeman, Salem, Oregon, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Vermont, in New York, paper rats on sticks bobbed along 6th Avenue as 200 protesters set off from Bryant Park. And so I applaud those who put their shoes on, hit the streets, and protested. For me, the issue is you can't just do it on May Day. You've got to fight every day. You've got to fight smart. You have to be strategic. We're up against some incredibly powerful forces who are enabled by people we thought were on our side. So if you can, make every day May Day, will you? Thanks for joining me for News and Comment. You can share this podcast with anyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter Bean.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.